The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone. So we're going to get straight into this. I'm here with Dr. Anthony Hinton. Many of you will know, as well as being a consultant surgeon for 30 years, he also was taken down from Twitter. I don't know why I'm laughing. It's preposterous. It's really out of order. But he was taken down from Twitter. And despite many people calling for him to come back, it was only recently he was back on there, but he continued on Getter. He has been consistently raising questions, challenging, speaking in the press, and putting forward a view. And unlike when people say to me things like, well, what do you know, which they're right about when it comes to medicine and science, because I like to talk about politics, democracy and freedom. But when they try and do that with him as well, which is quite interesting. So I'm very pleased now to welcome Dr. Anthony Hinton to our show. How are you doing?
I'm good, Alan. How are you?
Very, very good. Thanks. So thanks for joining us. I suppose, you know, like I do with a lot of people, but really, just so everyone can understand this, how did you get to what happened for you? What was your experience from the start of when the announcement of the lockdowns and with COVID? What just to explain to us that little journey to get you, you know, what happened in terms of how you responded to it and some of your thoughts?
Well, if you remember, it was the 23rd of March when the first lockdown was announced. And I didn't really have any bone to pick with the government at that time, because a lot of the things were just unknown. And there was obviously a sense of panic. And politicians are not going to get into trouble for being overcautious, but if they didn't react and there was a bad outcome, they would have been in real big trouble politically. So I can understand why they did that. But actually, I was following the figures. And when you looked at the figures for the number of deaths, either of or with COVID, we could argue about that. By the second week in April, that peak had been reached and the deaths were starting to fall. Now, you don't have to be a doctor, Alan, to work out a little bit of basic maths, that it takes roughly 4 weeks from when somebody might be first infected, get symptoms, get bad enough to go to hospital, bad enough to possibly go to the intensive care unit, and finally, sadly, bad enough to die. So if we trace back that peak of deaths the second week in April, we'd come to a peak of infections well before the lockdown started. So it was obvious that the lockdown was not needed to slow the infections. It is a natural thing. A virus will infect a certain number of people, and then some people that aren't infected start to be protected because there are people that have already had the virus that block its sort of transmission any further. So it naturally sort of goes down again. And that's just nature's way, that's not affected by anything that doctors or politicians do. And on the other hand, there was the issue that nobody knew at that point what the downsides of lockdown were going to be. It was obvious that there were going to be downsides. And in fact, I would say the downsides have turned out much, much worse than I ever expected. But there was obviously that trade-off. So I think by the time we got to certainly the middle or the end of April, all those restrictions should have been lifted and they should never have ever have been reimposed. I don't know whether you remember the second lockdown. The second lockdown was sort of towards end of November time 2020. Yeah. And there was a press conference and there were graphs that were presented, and the graphs were supposed to show up to, well over 4,000 deaths a day. And of course, it was a model by our infamous modeler friends. And there was also data that was coming in by that point. And the graph they put up on the screen included actually the dates of when that press conference was taking place. And when you looked at the graph, you could see that the estimate of what was supposed to be happening the date of the conference, that press conference, was about 1,000 deaths a day, and it was running at about 100. So this was all pointed out then in the newspapers the following day. Lots of people on Twitter were saying, look, you know, those graphs are obviously wrong. I think they were called out by the statistics authority. And I remember saying to my wife, well, thank goodness that's been identified, because it's obviously nonsense. They're not going to go ahead with this second lockdown now, because that wasn't coming in for about 4 or 5 days. And unbelievably, they still went ahead with it anyway. So it was just mad. So the lockdown is the first thing that I started to talk about on Twitter.
Yeah.
Cancers not being diagnosed, treatments not being done. But then actually the thing that really, really got to me that I just could not understand, because there was no logic for it, is that when this suggestion came that they were going to give these mRNA jabs to children, I just thought, this is nuts. There were no children included in the trials. There were no pregnant women included in the trials. In fact, you were excluded if you got pregnant. You didn't have any other doses. There were no very elderly people included in the trials, no very ill people included in the trials. The trials were just a fit, healthy people. And I just thought, this is mad. These children do not need these vaccines. No one knows what they are going to do long term. And in fact, you know, the Pfizer trial, the original Pfizer trial, the end date has only just gone. It was January 2023 was the end date of the trial. Right. And all this jab rollout started well before that. And the more I look back on things, that there's some very interesting data recently come out of Australia. Now, it's not new data to the authorities. It's new data to the public. I mean, the public were basically taken for fools, as on so many things. But on this, there were two particular aspects of this data that came out. It came out because of a Freedom of Information request. Interestingly, that request didn't come from a doctor. It didn't come from a scientist. It came from just a lay person in Australia, a lady, a very tenacious lady. And she got her first Freedom of Information quite a while ago, but about half of it was redacted, just black lines everywhere. And you really couldn't make head nor tail of the document. Anyway, she persevered, she appealed, went on for months and months and months. And very recently, she got a second release of the document with not all the redactions gone, but a lot of them were gone. And of course, people went straight to look at what was redacted before and what wasn't redacted on this second release. And there were two particular things in that. First of all, there was an experiment that was carried out by Pfizer infecting monkeys with COVID. And half of the monkeys were vaccinated and half weren't vaccinated. And what they did is they looked at what effect COVID had on those monkeys' lungs. And essentially, they found no difference whether they were vaccinated or not vaccinated. Then the second bit of concerning data that came out is that they'd also taken a whole group of mice and they looked at miscarriage rates, egg implantation rates in the mice, and how successfully they got pregnant and carried their pregnancy. And again, half the mice were vaccinated and half were not vaccinated. Now, there were miscarriages in both groups of mice, but the miscarriage rate in those that were vaccinated was double the amount of miscarriages in the ones that weren't vaccinated. Now, really, those two bits of data should have been enough for that to just go completely back to the drawing board and human trials not even start. It's just quite astonishing. Now, much, much worse than I ever expected would be revealed. And there are still bits in that document that are still redacted. So what on earth do those show?
So, okay, so on this, with the doctor's maxim, first do no harm.
Yes.
What do you think's happened? Right, just, that's a big question, but what do you think has happened in terms of the lockdowns, the push to then jab everyone, even when it was very clear to anyone who was looking at the data where the risk was with people, like in similar ways to people that are older and that are vulnerable. What do you think what do you think's happened?
Well, let's talk a bit about politicians and we talk a bit about doctors. So if we talk about politicians, if you remember originally, this jab was said to be for medical staff, so it would protect their patients, vulnerable people, people in care homes, and people over 70. That was about 7 million people. It was Matt Hancock's 15 million jabs to freedom, two jabs each, if you remember that.
Yeah.
And that, I think that was a perfectly reasonable proposal at that time, knowing probably what the politicians knew, because there were things, certainly, I think, that people like the MHRA, our sort of group of people that's supposed to check on drug safety, I think there were things they knew that should have stopped it, but that wasn't necessarily passed through up to politicians. So I think that was a perfectly reasonable starting point. But then what happened is that the jabs became very popular with the public. The jabs were also got all mixed up with this Brexit debate. Do you remember they even wanted to put a Union Jack on the AstraZeneca vials? And there was all this sort of competition of we were getting vaccines quicker than the EU. I mean, it was just silly schoolboy nonsense, really. Nothing to do with medicine. So it got sort of mixed up with, it was one of the benefits of Brexit that we were able to get these jabs quicker. Now, I'm a supporter of Brexit, but I just thought that was just such a childish argument. So it was mixed up with Brexit, became popular with the public. And then what you could see is that just before the jab started, Labour and Conservative were almost equal in the polls at that point. And as the jabs were rolled out, the gap between Conservative and Labour, with Conservative going up and Labour going down, just gradually got bigger and bigger and bigger. And you could almost put the graph of the number of vaccines rolled out on top of the graph of the popularity of the government and see one almost on top of the other exactly. And so it was politically popular and they were gaining from it politically. There was an argument. Do you remember who could forget the Matt Hancock WhatsApps? And there was one in particular where they were discussing the person that was in charge, the civil servant in charge of the jab rollout, who had, I think, at a press conference confirmed that these jabs were only meant for that small group of people. And Matt Hancock was going mad, saying, why on earth has she said that? And we don't know that yet. And so I think that's why they just continued to roll them out, that they were obviously never necessary for anybody below 70. In fact, my view, knowing what I know now, is I would argue they probably shouldn't have ever been given to anybody. But, people will differ on that point. But it's very hard for anyone to justify why you would give them to anyone below 70, because you just look at how many people you have to vaccinate to sort of save one person going to hospital or ITU, compared to the possible harms that we see now from the vaccine. Although rare, if you give them to millions and millions of people, you have a lot of people that are badly affected. I've seen lots of patients with vaccine injuries. I have more patients because of vaccine injuries than I have because of problems after COVID, probably a ratio 2-1.
Right.
So that they're not like any other jab, really. They're almost not a vaccine, because what happens is you inject this bit of genetic material, the genetic material gets into your cell then makes the vaccine, if you like. Your cell becomes the vaccine factory, producing the spike protein. But one of the issues with that is that you could give two people exactly the same dose of injection, but they could make completely different amounts of the spike protein. And maybe that's why some people have no problems, some people have lots of problems. I took two of the Pfizer doses initially, and to my knowledge, I have no problems. And the reason I took that is because I was being told at the time by government ministers and by people like Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, that it was going to protect my patients because I would not be able to catch COVID and I wouldn't be able to transmit it on. So right. I thought, well, I guess I better take it. I didn't want to take it particularly. I didn't feel that I needed it to protect me. I'd been mixing with my son for a whole year before that, and he was looking after COVID patients on the ward, and none of us were ill from that. So I feel the sort of almost, I took it under sort of medical misinformation, if you like, because within about 2 months of me taking the second dose, I was hearing of people that had two doses and were catching COVID and passing it on. I just thought, well, right. It doesn't stop catching it and passing it on. And well, I think that's pretty
well. Can I just hold you there for 1 minute? Yeah, Anthony, I want to come back to this. We've got to take a very short break. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Dr. Tony Hinton, and this is TNT Radio. We'll see you in just a second.
TNT Radio's Jeremy Nell and Germ Warfare.
I like Trump. All right, so let me just throw it out there. I like Trump. When he won in 2016, I remember my wife and I woke up in the morning and we had a little celebration because every establishment media outlet was projecting a Clinton win. And it was so wonderful to see how he just turned that thing on its head. I know that Trump is flawed. He is a politician. Warp Speed was a disastrous campaign, and he's done a few other policy decisions as president that I didn't like, but it doesn't really matter because I'm not American, so I'm just an outsider observing. I kind of get the feeling though that he shouldn't run for president. I don't know. I think he had his time. I can't tell you why. I just somehow think that he's a little too cocksure of himself. I suspect Ron DeSantis might take him in the final lap. I'm not sure. But we'll see how it goes.
Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
Are we on the air?
Am I on the air?
You're on the air.
On the air 24/7. Your news talk giant, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Alan Miller here with Dr. Tony Hinton. We just saw that advert, actually, with Dr. Tess Lowry, the World Council of Health. Anthony, when I'm in New York, which I go back and forth quite a bit to, through the letterboxes, you get promotional flyers to be vaccinating toddlers. And it is quite astonishing that New York, particularly New York City, that had always associated itself with the ideas of freedom and independence. During this period, on the one hand, wanted to impose all these things on children and continue to do so, as well as having mandates that continue at places like Johns Hopkins University, mask wearing carried on at Columbia University right into this summer, last summer. And you just think that in terms of children and young people and this procedure, and we see as well, don't we, that this is going to be, the boosters are being promoted. I noted your tweet today that you said you thought this could have been an April Fool's joke, but that with some of them to children, less than 6 months old. And you think, what is going on?
No, it's absolutely crazy. I would say, I would liken it to child abuse. I would say it's criminal. I cannot get my head round why any medical professional would want to inject a child 6 months old that is at absolutely zero risk from this disease. We know there are certain known risks of these vaccines. No one knows what the long-term consequences of injecting a six-month-old. No trials have ever been carried out. And we're talking now about injecting boosters, some of which were only tested on 8 mice before they were injected into humans. It's just amazing. Now, if we look at let's look at what's happened in the UK. We're certainly not as crazy as in the United States. But if we look at vaccinating kids in the UK, that was all supposed to be decided by a group called the JCVI, who recommend various vaccines for various groups, from elderly to adults to kids. And they were asked about vaccinating 12 to 16s. Now, actually, the first time they were asked by the government, what they said was, well, they couldn't really see any medical reason for it. They were a bit worried about, they were just about hearing about cases of myocarditis and stuff from the States who had already started vaccinating younger children. And they wanted to see some more data. They were going to give it maybe 3 or 4 months and then revisit it. Anyway, that obviously wasn't good enough. So obviously someone from the government had a little word with them. And 2 weeks later, they convened another meeting. And at that meeting, the conclusion was they still couldn't see a medical reason. It was marginal. You could argue it either way. So what they did is they were like Pontius Pilate. They washed their hands of it and they handed it back to the government and said, maybe there is some sort of educational reason why it should be done. We'll leave it to the chief medical officers. Now, they didn't come up that with themselves. They were told to say that. And surprise, surprise, then the chief medical officers decided, they did some convoluted calculation and decided by vaccinating all 12 to 16-year-olds, it would save an average of 15 minutes school time because the number of children that then wouldn't get COVID. So, of course, we all said straight away, well, hang on a minute, it's going to save the average school child 15 minutes. How long does it take them to leave the class, go to the medical room, have their vaccine, sit there for 15 minutes to check they're okay, and come back to class, even if they have no time off because they're feeling ill afterwards the next day? That's well more than your 15 minutes you're saving. It makes no sense. So the JCVI never recommended vaccines for 12 to 16s. When it came to ones from 5 to 12, again, that went to the JCVI, and they stalled for weeks and weeks and weeks. And again, they still didn't recommend it. What they said was they were going to leave it as an open offer to parents, which I thought, well, that's just like saying, it's on you. If there's a problem, don't blame us because we never said for you to take it. So they never really recommended it for children at all. And if we look now what's happening with vaccines in the UK. There are a couple of MPs that are raising these questions in the Commons, and every time they do, the rest of the Commons just completely empties. And there's like two or three MPs there, a government minister to answer, and the speaker, and that's it. It's just disgraceful that MPs are not engaging and discussing these subjects that are affecting their constituents who they're supposed to be representing. So the latest sort of announcements are from February, you couldn't get a vaccine if you were under 50. Then there were some new boosters announced, and it's gone from 50 to 75. You can't get a spring booster if you're below 75. So at that rate, by the time we get to the autumn boosters, they should add on another 25 years. And so you won't be able to get anything unless you're under 100. So I said, what have the government got against the poor old 100-year-old people? They used to get a card from the Queen. Now they're going to get just a booster. So what's happening in the UK is they're slowly withdrawing all these vaccinations for everybody because they know there are problems. You know, the government, that they won't acknowledge it, but they cannot not know. I do not believe that. You know, we've got a very good reporting system in this country, the yellow card system.
Yeah. It's probably well, the thing, the point they make just on that. On that, Anthony, the point, though, because they're saying that it's going to be offered to millions, this booster. I don't know if that's true or not. But the point they will make, people will make, is that, and we've all seen anyone who's sent in responses to the petition and to things on the yellow card, is that the response is that there are a variety of side effects. Many of them are nominal, is what they'll say. They've batched them together, quite a lot of them. I don't know how much there's been a fisking of every single thing. We do know, of course, that some people have been awarded compensation, but many of them haven't even been paid yet. And we know that, yeah, of course, there are some very serious things, and that those cases have been brought up and they've been pursued by some people, often in very difficult circumstances, it's got to be said, where people are smearing people and saying all that. It's horrendous, yeah, right? But what they'll say is that, I talked earlier on in the previous hour with Professor David Payton, and we were talking about cost benefits. What they'll say is, we get that. No one likes to say this directly because no one likes to say that there's ever anything that goes wrong. But people will say, but if you assess it all and you look at it and you say where we were and what we thought and what it means now, that overall, we still did best endeavours and it still protected people. And it is bad that there's side effects, but we know that there's always side effects with some things. And you guys are focusing on all this too much. You're making that bit much too much of a focus. I mean, how would you deal with that assertion?
Yeah, well, you can compare these mRNA vaccines to previous vaccines and how many reports of adverse reactions and deaths came from previous vaccines. Now, when you do that, the number of adverse reactions and deaths reported for these COVID mRNA vaccines in the last 2 years is a larger number than all of the other vaccines put together for the past 40 years. Now, that can't be ignored. Now, right, of course, people will come back and say, well, yes, a lot more vaccines have been given, though, than in a normal 2-year period. And I would say, absolutely, that is correct. But if you look at that, the increase in the number of vaccines over normal is about 4 times. The increase in the number of adverse reactions and deaths from vaccines is up about 16 times. So if it was purely just more vaccines were being given, 4 times more vaccines, you'd expect 4 times more bad reactions. But it's not. It's 4 times more than you would expect for the increase in vaccines. So it cannot be ignored. And actually, do you know, I'm quite embarrassed by our own Parliament and most of our own MPs, Because if you look at what's happening in the Australian equivalent, if you look what's happening in the American equivalent, these things now are being openly discussed. And they're getting, and even in the EU to a certain extent, and they're bringing in people like the chief executive as Pfizer and Moderna to be questioned by committees. And we're just doing nothing. We've just got our head in the sand. But of course, the good thing is that these things only need to come out in one country. Once they're out in one country, everybody knows everywhere. So there will be no hiding this. The truth will come out. As I watch the truth coming out, it always turns out actually worse than I ever predicted, sadly.
One of the things about that is to say that the thing that's always been very, very problematic, in my opinion, is that anyone who's trying to make sense of this, there's been a suppression of the debate and discussion. So you yourself were taken off of Twitter for making a point that you know, just basically making a comparison, which you can tell us about. But basically, any attempt to engage or discuss or have these discussions was smeared, had an attack strategy, people were taken down, and was not pretty much not allowed in the mainstream media, but many people in the media, editors and others and journalists, went along with it and championed it. So actually Ofcom had stressed about broadcast, you know, and what should be done in terms of this kind of new situation. So it's very, very, you know, and even now, like, so when you say, well, the truth will come out, it's like, I see that in South Africa, there's now a legal case that's coming out. And we know that people try legal cases, yeah. They do various things like that. But we've not seen anything about that in the media. And it does seem to me that sometimes things take quite a long time. And even then, in terms of a kind of recognition or a consensus, or it seems almost like we're in these silos. We're in these echoes. The people who agree with each other are all saying, we all know this to be true. And that's equally true of people that were critical of what's been going on, as well as people who have been champions of it. So I don't know how, you know, if it, what you think about that, but just, I mean, under your point about, well, the truth will come out and everyone will know it. I know you sometimes give the example of thalidomide. That took a long time for that to become apparent.
It took 4 years for it to be taken off the market. And in fact, 4 years is the average time it takes for it to be discovered that a drug is having serious side effects and to be removed from the market. That is the average time. And that's exactly what it was for thalidomide. But actually, thalidomide, that was made by a German company, Bayer, I think it was. And they did do a huge payout not that long ago, probably 10 or 15 years ago, but with no admission of liability. I mean, to a certain extent, you're admitting some liability by paying out a huge amount of money. But legally, they wouldn't admit liability because they wanted to draw a line under it.
Tell us also what happened just briefly before we go to the next break in a couple of minutes. Tell us what happened. Why did you get taken down from Twitter? What was the post?
Well, the post, well, we should maybe talk a bit more about censorship as well, which we'll come back to afterwards. But that tweet post, I was on holiday and I was about to go into a sauna and I saw a sign outside the sauna. It said, please don't use the sauna if you've got heart problems or if you're pregnant. And I just thought, wow, so many things we say to pregnant women you mustn't do. You mustn't go in a sauna. You mustn't drink wine. You mustn't smoke. You mustn't take any of these various drugs. You mustn't have soft cheese. You mustn't have eggs that aren't properly cooked. And so I put that in a tweet with a photograph of this sign. And I said, but you can take a safe and effective mRNA injection. I didn't say you should or you shouldn't. It was to put in people's minds that difference, and were we being not careful enough with recommending this new treatment to pregnant women? That was my tweet. And I was off the next day. And I wasn't back for 6 months.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's not unbelievable in the context of all the things that were happening, but that climate of you're not allowed to say that and shut up and we're going to take you down for being dangerous was the environment that we lived in, as well as smearing of people where some were getting their jobs threatened. They were getting hauled up in front of their bosses. We saw all of that. Well. Did you? Yeah.
I did.
What happened?
Yeah. Well, I had a lot of sort of a Twitter pile-on I had by sort of trolls. And then the next thing I knew, I was being called in to the two places I work for discussions with the medical director and the chief executive to talk about my Twitter feed. So I went in for these meetings and I said, well, they'd had complaints, they said. So I said, are these complaints for my patients? No, they're not complaints from your patients. So I said, so what are they complaining about? What have I said that they disagree with? No, they haven't complained about any specific things you've said. They just don't want you saying anything. I said, right. I said, well, do I not have freedom of expression? As long as I said, generally the things I'm tweeting, I've either got a scientific paper that will support it. Often it's government data that I'm using.
Yeah.
And they said these words only struck me the other day, actually. Maybe we'll come back to it after the break, in that they said they have to be seen as a company, as a business, to support the government line. That was the exact words from both places independently. And it only struck me the other day. I'll tell you what it struck me after the break. But I thought, that's weird. So anyway, what we agreed was that I could continue with my Twitter feed. I had to make it just clear to say that they were my own views. And that's all I did. And a lot of those trolls, I sort of, because I had a sort of policy of not blocking anyone. I wanted to engage with people and try to convince them of my view with reasoned argument and data. But I just had to cancel a whole load of these people that had done this pile on. And it all sort of went very quiet. Then it all just settled down.
Wow. Well, look, the land of Stasi is what we got into. It was terrifying. Are you, or have you ever been a bit like the McCarthy witch hunts? I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Dr. Anthony Hinton. This is TNT Radio. We'll see you in just a moment.
Oh, my. Polar bears are disappearing, but only from Al Gore's books and movies. Their numbers are hitting record levels.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
In Al Gore's first film, An Inconvenient Truth, in 2006, he made the polar bear the icon, the poster child of his film, claiming that the polar bear was hanging on to the last ice cube in the Arctic and was soon to go extinct. Fast forward to 2023, and the polar bears are now at or near historic population highs, and Al Gore's sequel? Nary a mention of the polar bear. Polar bear expert Dr. Susan Crockford has says polar bears turned out to be more flexible and resilient than predicted. You gotta hand it to Al Gore. Instead of dealing with the issue head on, he just acted like he never even talked about polar bears in his sequel. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
In a March 19 executive order, President Zelensky invoked martial law to ban 11 opposition parties. The outlawed parties consisted of the entire left-wing socialists or anti-NATO parties in Ukraine, openly fascist and pro-Nazi parties like the Azov National Corps were unaffected by the presidential decree. President Zelensky ordered an unprecedented domestic propaganda initiative to nationalize all television news broadcasting and combine all channels into a single 24-hour channel called United News to tell the truth about war. On April 12th, President Zelensky announced the arrest of his main political rival, Viktor Medvedchuk, by the SBU security services.
If you're talking about it,
over 6,000 migrants per day on average were apprehended after illegally crossing the border.
We're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. I'm Alan Miller. I was just in the midst of it with Dr. Anthony Hinton. We were going to talk a bit more just about censorship. You were talking about how you got hauled in front of your employers, having to explain why you should have freedom of expression. And we chuckle, but I mean, it's not a chuckling matter at all. We've seen that as well, haven't we? That the legislation, some of the measures that were brought in to stop protests, and also the online safety bill where freedom of speech is outsourced to the TNCs of Silicon Valley, a range of measures actually in terms of surveillance and other things that are happening, that this whole climate of the technocrats know best and you shouldn't make, you know, you shouldn't be saying things that are challenging the consensus or being what some might consider to be beyond the pale. It's a real concern, isn't it? I mean, we can't really have science without clashes of ideas and thoughts either, can we? I mean, that's is predicated on freedom of speech and also on contesting ideas.
Absolutely. Science is never fixed. There's no such thing as the science trademark, as Dr. Fauci would like to say. But just going back to that thing where I had these two work meetings, I didn't take it in any way personally, really, because I knew that what these people that were doing, that were complaining, was not directed personally against me. It was try to shut me down to frighten other people from speaking out. That was the aim of the exercise. Right. And actually, it turned out to be, I think it's more sinister than I at first realized, because do you remember the Big Brother report, that 100-page report that they got hold of information of where the British government had been contacting various social media companies to suppress what people were saying and get people banned?
Yeah.
I was talking to a colleague about it, and they said, have you read the Big Brother report? And I said, it's about 100 pages long. I said, I can't go through all that. Anyway, if I'm not in it, I'll be totally embarrassed. So anyway, within half an hour, somebody contacted me and they said, you're on page 46. So I quickly turned to page 46 and there it was, them discussing some of my tweets that I'd done. At that point, it was about lockdown and the harms lockdown were doing, which I think most people agree now. Lockdowns were not a particularly good idea, should we say, at the least. But the date of that meeting and discussion in a cabinet committee about my tweets was the 28th of October. I was called into both those two workplaces towards the end of November. And both of them independently used the phrase, they had to be seen to supporting the government line. And I thought, why did they just both come up with that? They were obviously spoken to by somebody from that committee. I mean, I can't come to any other conclusion. I might ask them. I'm quite good friends with them, so they may tell me. But you know, to go to those lengths, and of course, when you look at all the things that happened, so let's just go back to the beginning. You know, the sort of ridiculing of certain treatments that could have been used, things like hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. The lockdowns just following this sort of Chinese model rather than a perfectly good pandemic plan that we'd worked out over 20 years that was just thrown out of the window. And then this other strange ideas like you couldn't possibly get immune from having caught COVID. You could only get immune by having this injection. That's like no other disease on earth. And all of those things happened because of that censorship. If there'd been discussion of those things openly, I believe probably none of those things would have ever have got through. They would have never have happened. I mean, government should have encouraged, you know, I didn't mind that the government were listening to me. I only wish they'd got a few of us in and discussed it with us and got some other views. So it's not the government's job to just do whatever Sage tells them to do. They should take advice from Sage. They should take advice from the Great Barrington Declaration people. They should take advice from people like Carl Hennigan from Oxford University. And then they should look at all that evidence, and then they have to make the decision and take the responsibility of which they think is the best way to go. This sort of abdication of we're just following the science, so almost if it all goes wrong, you can't blame us because we just did what they told us to do, just doesn't cut the mustard, I'm afraid. That is not government's job. That they don't do it on anything else. They take a range of views and then they come to a reasoned decision as a way forward. So the biggest problem of this whole 3 years has been the censorship. All the other mistakes come from the censorship.
So if we have, I think you've made a very robust case there for what we're doing at the Together Cabinet, actually, which is to have a number of us, you included, be able to be constantly speaking in the public, to have reports going out to influence both in the press and also MPs and councillors and others, but also that politicians should decide on policy based on getting all the information and assessing and evaluating properly and fully all the way around. And I think the role of the public within all of that is to hold everyone accountable. I mean, that's the thing that's missing as well. If we could, and obviously it was very unique situation and circumstances, right? Where people were kind of pushed away, the public, a million people volunteered to do things, but we were pushed away to one side. But now moving forwards, as we're doing lots of different things and we're seeing measures happen to us, being told, well, this is for your own good, to keep you safe or to make things better. That might be to do with low traffic neighborhoods or 15 minute cities, whatever it is. We are in a position to have our voices heard, aren't we? And actually to get the public involved. I mean, that would, on a finishing note, I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Anthony, just before we go.
Yeah, the public have to stop being ignored. So if we look at things like LTNs and these ULEZ in London, that there are sort of like, I would call them pretend consultations. And it can be very obvious from the consultation that whatever is being proposed is extremely unpopular with the public. And yet it still goes ahead regardless. Maybe we should have more of a situation in Switzerland, for instance. Regularly, whenever they have elections, local council elections or national elections, they'll have little referendums attached. They can be sort of on a national question. They can be very local questions to that particular sort of town or that particular canton. And unless the thing gets passed by 50% plus one of the people voting, that proposal won't go through. Yeah. Maybe that's what we should be having for things like LTNs.
It's a very good idea. It's a very good idea and a very good thought. In fact, again, unfortunately, in Cambridge, some of them tried that, and it was some of the MPs didn't get behind it. But it's a good idea, and particularly with local councillors having a referendum in areas. But I want to thank you for coming on the show. Thank you to Dr. Tony Hinton. I really appreciate it. Many of you will know where you can see him, but if you go to his Twitter, he's there. He's also on the feed on mine, at Alan Vibe. In this last part of the show, I just wanted to say that all of the things we've been talking about today just reinforce for us the need to have the public at the heart of things. We were told that things were being done for our own good, but often, if you did the cost-benefit analysis, we're seeing the consequences of the harms and damages now, and we're having to not just see them, but we're having to live with them, and they have enormous implications and consequences. And that's why the one thing that has come out of the last period is that we're now organized, and we have the togetherdeclaration.org, which you can go to and have a look at the site and get involved with us. But we can actually campaign and have our voices heard. We managed to challenge and stop the vaccine mandate. We campaign against vaccine passports. We work with people across the board to do that, with NHS 100 and frontline staff running videos and campaigns and getting the public behind it. And we're doing a similar thing now with the deficit in the democratic accountability around low traffic neighbourhoods, around ULEZ, around CAS in the Midlands, in Birmingham, the clean air zone charges that 70,000 people or so have not paid. And I was just at a really good event in Birmingham at King's Heath on Thursday. Big shout out to everyone there. Packed room. And what you find in all these meetings, the same as when we did one in Bath and when you do them in Oxford and other areas, is that our residents, our communities, our friends and colleagues and work neighbours, all of the people around us, we understand what's going on. We have ideas, but the technocrats that are running things seem to think that they shouldn't engage with us. It doesn't matter what we think and say when they do these so-called consultations. And we see that they're going to go ahead anyway, whether that's Duncan Enright in Oxford, whether that's Mike Hakata in Haringey, any number of others in Bath and Canterbury and elsewhere. But we are seeing some changes. So we've seen that in Bath. Councillors now have had to go and speak to Moorland business community, who are at our event and have been challenging the low traffic neighbours about the impacts and the parking zones, the impacts of the parking zones on retail and others there. So that's a fantastic thing. We're seeing that things are changing. Obviously, we're seeing some people taking things into their own hands. We're seeing in Leicester and in Rochdale, as well as we saw in Ealing and elsewhere. And we know that the way that we get change is that we get enough of us behind it, we get campaigning, and we've got calls to action to email and call and write letters and go to the surgeries of your councillors and your MPs, to write to Mark Harper, to campaign, to organise rallies and protests up and down the country. We've got a big one that's organised for the 15th of April in Trafalgar Square. That's Saturday, the 15th of April, Trafalgar Square at midday, which is going to be saying no to you, Liz. We know that as well as many borough leaders and councillors and council leaders in and outside London who are opposing you, Liz. Many have said they won't implement it, they won't go along with it. Some have taken a judicial review against it. We also know that other MPs, as well as some Labour MPs, have challenged Sadiq Khan on it. We know that he has ignored the consultation, the 65% who said they don't want it, as well as 5,000 people, Fair Fuel supporters. He bought the cameras already in advance of the consultation. And he's also using very, very misinformed data to say that 4,000 people are dying from it. It's absolutely not true. We've got a report at togetherdeclaration.org, Ben Powell, at climate activist. You can see that on the site. I'd invite you to join us to have your voices heard and get involved, because that's the way we see things changed. Up and down the country, we're seeing that happen. We're seeing it happen in Cambridge. We're seeing it happen in Thetford, in Norfolk. We've just seen it in Glastonbury and a range of other places where people are taking it upon themselves to address their councillors, who are often only voted in by a few hundred people. Obviously, on May the 4th, we've got elections. The deadline to be an independent councillor is April the 4th. There's still a chance to register if you want to with the LGA. You can do it via the Democratic Network as well, with Nigel Jacklin. Big shout out to him and the Independent Network if you want to have your voices heard. But what's really, really vital for us in the next period is to make sure that the public are put front and centre of things, to have our voices heard, to not be sidelined or treated with contempt in a similar fashion to what happened in the last few years during COVID, for them to say, go and be quiet, stand in the corner, put your hands on your heads whilst we do what's best. No. We need to make sure we do a proper cost-benefit analysis, that we have proper scrutiny, that we have proper evaluation, and that what the public needs, what we need, is at the heart of things. There's currently an attack. There's a war on cars and there's a war on individuals, and it often impacts the worst off the worst, the lowest socioeconomic groups. And now's the time to say we're going to put a stop to it. And I think we can do that with you, Les. I'd invite everyone to come and join us on the 15th of April. We're doing that with Action on You, Les, and many other people that are going to be involved in speaking there. There's going to be more news that we're announcing, as I've said, as well as having informally launched the cabinet with reports, that with Harry Miller, who's doing stuff on our law and order, and with Ben Powell on energy. We've got more reports coming in different sectors, and we're going to be doing a much bigger launch as well soon. So do get involved. What we do in every town and city up and down the country in every region has an impact. It has an impact if we get our voices heard, if we get people involved. Join as a member for Together. Get involved, have your voices heard. We've got big questions and big issues to fight. I likened it on Thursday to some of the big challenges historically, like the enclosures and whether you're a leveller and a digger, and even the Chartist movement. The time is now, if you believe in freedom, to get involved together. Let the public have its voices heard. Make sure technocrats listen to us. Make sure we can shape the future of where we're going in our country and shine a light internationally to everyone else. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. We'll see you same time next week. Thanks very much for joining me.